This world is so small, the reference to him, concerning him, are indeed significant, that he certainly did exist. So I want to lay that down, first of all, this morning, that no one can argue that Jesus did not exist. It's a fact of history. There was a man by the name of Jesus of Nazareth, and we know he died. Now, that's what we know about Jesus. Now, let's examine the facts around the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. I'm going to throw out some easy questions, some softballs, so feel free to answer those questions, and also feel free to make any comments as we go along about some of the subjects, or even ask questions about this. But first of all, a very simple question: how did Jesus die? What do we know historically about how Jesus died? He died on a Roman cross, a particular, a specific type of execution during that particular day. Now, as some will note, as we will note as we go along here, some postulate that Jesus did not die. But the Bible leaves no room of argument on this. Christ died. What do we know in John chapter 20, for example, or John chapter 19, for example, when he was hanging upon the cross? It was becoming the end of the day, and they wanted to speed up the crucifixion. How did they make sure that the people were dead who were hanging on the cross? Yeah, okay, they pierced the side, but first they broke the legs. You remember the soldier came along and first broke the legs of one, broke the legs of another. But coming to Jesus, what did he find? They put the spear into his side because he found that these legs didn't need to be broken because Jesus was already dead. Now, I understand that when a person died on the cross, he actually died of suffocation, that he was hanging on the cross for some time, and yet he would have to pull himself up because of his abdomen pressing against his lungs. He could not get a breath. So in order to get a breath, he would have to push up with his legs and pull down with his arms on the cross just to get a breath. And it would be excruciating pain that would go through his legs and the nails in his wrist as he did that. And so it would be very, very difficult to catch a breath. But the problem is if they wanted to speed up the crucifixion, if they wanted him to die quicker, they would simply break his legs so that he could not get a breath and then suffocate to death. Well, coming to Jesus, that wasn't the case, and it would fulfill the prophecy that not a single bone was broken in Jesus' body at his death. And so instead, when they came to Jesus and found him dead, they put a spear into his side. And you remember what came out as the spear went into his side? Blood and water, indicating maybe the water was had already gone up around the heart. Maybe he had had already some type of something that had caused him to die already in his chest, and it came forth as it pierced that. So blood and water both came out. But John says, I saw this happen in John 19, in verses 34 and 35. In verse 35 says, he who has seen is borne witness, and his witness is true, and he knows that he's telling the truth, so you may believe. I saw this happen. Now, let me tell you again, who was it that pierced the side of Jesus? A Roman soldier. Do you think a Roman soldier ever saw a dead person before? Especially one who was in charge of a crucifixion. He knew a dead person when he saw it. And just to make sure, he put the spear in his side. And so later on, you remember Joseph of Arimathea comes and he requests the body of Jesus to give him a proper burial. He goes to Pilate and asks him that question. But what does Pilate do before he just turns the body over to Joseph? He makes sure that he's dead. He asks the centurion, is this person dead? And then having the certainty of that, he then turned the body over to Jesus. And again, I ask you, do you think a centurion knew a dead person when he saw it? And remember, he was standing at the foot of the cross, and when Jesus died, he said, certainly, this is the Son of God. When they went to bury Jesus and prep his body, there was no signs that he was alive or he was breathing. Certainly, the people who were preparing his body would have seen that if that was the case. So the idea that Jesus didn't really die on the cross is an invention of modern unbelievers. All the available evidence that we have shows that Christ did die, and so we have to be satisfied with that. So after Jesus died, what did they do with his body? Well, they buried it. And at first they, what was that, sir? They prepared his body. They anointed it with spices and myrrh and those types of things. In fact, verse 40 of John 19 says the method of burial that they used for Jesus was according to the custom of the Jews. Now, while the Romans, they would leave a body hanging on a cross, maybe even for days, for humiliation purposes, the Jews did not do that. In fact, they weren't even allowed to allow someone to hang on the cross overnight. But the burial, as they would do it according to the custom of the Jews, what we know about their burial process is they would lay the body out straight. They would wash down the body completely. And then they would put these spices, like Nicodemus brought, for example, there in verse 39, about 100 pounds weight of spices to anoint the body. And they would put a covering over his head as they buried him. And so I would say this, if he wasn't already dead, after putting 100 pounds of linens and spices on him, certainly he would be dead by now. He would certainly suffocate with this covering that would be over that body. The method of burial doesn't allow for a theory to argue that Jesus didn't really die. Now, again, where did they bury Jesus? In a tomb, which is very significant, because they weren't like our types of burial places today in the ground. They were carved into the side of a mountain. There was no back door that anyone could escape out of. And what do we know about this particular tomb that Joseph of Arimathea had? It was a brand new tomb. No one had ever been laid in it, according to Luke chapter 23 and verse 53. And that's significant because some tombs would house several bodies. But there was no tomb in this, and the fact that there was no one else in this tomb negates the possibility of mistaking the body for another, for Jesus. When they came on the third day and saw the tomb was empty, it wasn't that they just mistake and said, oh, Jesus' body is gone, but there's a few other bodies here. All the bodies. There was no body in the tomb that particular day. And then they also made it secure. How did they secure the tomb? Yeah, the first thing that they did was they rolled a big stone in front of it. Generally speaking, the tombs that that have been discovered over in Palestine are generally about 4.5 to 5 feet tall, the opening to the tombs are. And they would have a groove that was cut out before it, and a large round stone is rolled in front of it. And it's downhill, and there would be a little groove at the bottom that would be hard to move that out. The stone that was rolled in front of it would be 1.5 to 2 tons in weight. And so you would have to, if you're going to remove this stone, push it uphill, something that would be very difficult. In fact, the Bible records that the stone that was covering the tomb of Jesus in Matthew chapter 27, he calls it a large stone. In Mark chapter 16 and verse 4, it is referred to as an extremely large stone. In fact, in verse 3 of Mark chapter 16, the women who would go to anoint Jesus' body on the first day of the week, they're wondering, who's going to roll away the stone for us? How are we going to do this? And we know there's at least 4 or maybe even 5 women who are there who realize they cannot do this. And so it was, the stone is in front of it. What else did they do to secure the tomb? Okay, they put a seal on it, okay, after they closed it up. And this seal would be have wax on one side, a cord stretched across it, and wax on the other side with the Roman governor's signet on it. And anyone, of course, who would break the seal would be in trouble with the Roman governor. What else? There was a guard that was put in front of it. You remember in Matthew chapter 27 that some of the enemies of Jesus came to him and said, you know, when this liar was still alive, he said that he would be resurrected on the third day. And we're afraid that some disciples are going to come and steal away the body. We want a Roman guard. We want a guard, rather. And Pilate says, you have a guard, go do with it what you want to do. And so a Roman guard, whether that was what they used here or not, was usually a 4 to 16 man force, and each man was trained to protect 6 feet of ground. Now, we don't know if that's what they had here, but this is what was typical. 4 men would be on duty while 12 others slept, and then they would rotate. And so it would have been virtually impossible to tamper with the tomb. What would happen if one of those soldiers fell asleep on their job? Yeah, they would be executed. Remember the Philippian jailer of what he was scared of in, of course, Acts chapter 16. And so all of these things, as we look at this, it shows that the tomb was secured with great caution. The details of the burial of Jesus are important because they help us better understand the tremendous evidence of the resurrection. Now, what happens, though, when we come to the third day? What do the women find as they come to the tomb? The stone is rolled away, and the body is missing. The seal that we mentioned is broken, which, of course, the consequences of were severe. The stone was moved, a feat which was difficult at best. The guard had fled, which was an act that was punishable by death. And the grave clothes, do you remember the grave clothes? What was unique about the grave clothes that we find? Neatly folded and in place, as Peter and John run to the tomb and find out after the women report to them. Who is it that sees the empty tomb first? Okay, yeah, and not specifically looking for names, but yeah, the women, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, Salome, and Luke chapter 24 tells us Joanna and some other women came to the tomb on the first day of the week. Now, that's significant that these women are mentioned, and there's two reasons why. Number one, their names are mentioned by name. These are real people. These aren't things that are made up. And these were witnesses to the tomb, that they see this. So in the first century, as these gospel writings are being written within 40 years, and some of them even earlier than that, that one could go to these women and say, is this really what you saw? They were alive, and they could verify this. Go and ask them. And so they could. The names there that are mentioned are significant. But I tell you another reason why it is significant that women are the first witnesses to the empty tomb is because according to Jewish principles of legal evidence, women were considered invalid witnesses. Women did not have the right to testify in a court of law under the Jewish system. What that means is, if this is a story, this resurrection story, that the early writers were just making up, by Jesus' own disciples, it would have been highly unlikely that they would include women as the first witnesses to this event. So, I mean, if you're making up this story, you're going to get some valid witnesses in there, right? So why would they record women as being the first ones to do this? Because that's what happened, exactly. This is what really happened. They were interested in the truth and what was recorded as they wrote that down. So I think these are very powerful in terms of the authenticity of these accounts. Also, we see that when the tomb was found empty, Jesus then started appearing to many eyewitnesses. Paul claims in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 that there was a substantial number of witnesses. In fact, he says at one time there were over 500 men at one time. I want you to think about that for a moment. Joe told me to pick on Trevor. Trevor. He didn't say that way. But let's suppose... Yeah, I guess he did. Okay. Let's suppose that someone says, I saw Trevor robbing the gas station the other day. He ran out with a bunch of Twinkies. I saw that happen. And then another person comes along and says, well, I saw Trevor running out of the store with a bunch of Twinkies. You know, you would start to say, well, okay, there's two eyewitnesses here to this. That must have been what happened. What if in the court of law, a third witness came in there and said, I saw Trevor run out with a box of Twinkies. You would say, okay, this guy is guilty. But imagine 500 people coming through on the witness stand and saying they saw Trevor do this. Obviously, it would be the most lopsided case in all of history. And that is what we find here as well. We have 500 witnesses to the fact that they saw Jesus after he had died. And so the record of appearances of Jesus occurred from the morning of his resurrection to his ascension 40 days later. In fact, there are 10 distinct appearances that are recorded. And they show great variety as to time and place and people. Three of those appearances were to individuals, Peter, James, and Mary Magdalene. There were appearances to the group of women, the disciples as a group. One, as I mentioned, was to 500 assembled brethren. And they were in different places. Some were in the garden, some were in the upper room. One was on the way, the road to Emmaus. Some were as far away as Galilee. And the eyewitnesses, the conclusions that they came to are published here in the Bible for us. Now, I like to ask this question. This is simply an opinion question, your own opinion. What do you think is the most significant post-resurrection appearance in your thoughts? Which one is the most impactful to you? Anyone want to share what you think? Thomas. Yeah. Because here's a man. Why do you think that is such a significant one?
Because he doubted.
He doubted. I would have been Thomas. I would be the one, show me the proof. If I do not put my finger in his side and see those things, I'm not going to believe. And yet, 7 days later, when he sees that, he does believe, doesn't he? An amazing turnaround. But I also have to think about the Apostle Paul as well. Because when Paul sees Jesus resurrected from the dead, where is he going? What is he on his way to do? In fact, he is on the way to put to death people who say they believe Jesus is resurrected from the dead. And all of a sudden, he changes. Afterwards, he suddenly switched from being the worst enemy of Christianity to maybe its greatest friend. Without the resurrection, how can you explain that transformation? But here's the question. Are these witnesses, are they credible? Because if they're not, we might as well throw it all out. I want you to understand, the disciples who were downtrodden at his death were boldly preaching the resurrection now and willing to die for it. In John chapter 20, they are locking themselves up in the upper room or in a room by themselves because it says of the fear of the Jews. These witnesses stand for truth and honesty. They live for it and they died for it. Would it make sense to believe that liars would be responsible for preaching and for dying for the greatest morals ever known? Could a fabricated lie account for their change in behavior and their willingness to die for the resurrection of Christ? What could they have gained by lying? You think about that. Why do people lie? What's the benefit of lying? That's
benefit.
Yeah, for their benefit. Maybe to get out of trouble. Maybe for popularity. Maybe for there's a monetary benefit of some type. That wasn't the case with the apostles. They lost money. They lost their lives. Maybe they came popular, but not in the way that they wanted to become popular, but most men do anyway. And so all of the evidence points to the credibility of these witnesses. Only bias, I think, would cause one to impeach their character as credible witnesses to the resurrection of Jesus Christ. So what I want you to understand is these are simply the facts that I'm putting before you today. Did Jesus rise from the dead? Either he did or he didn't. There's no middle ground. And I think these facts seem to suggest that he did. Two main essential facts are this. There's an empty grave that has to be accounted for because Jesus died. And number two, there are all these eyewitnesses that say they saw Jesus after his death. How do you explain those two things if Jesus did not rise from the dead? Well, attempts have been made. And that's what I want to spend the next few moments in talking about. Some of the attempts that have been made to explain away these facts. There are various theories that have been put forth to explain these things, and I think we have to look at those. Just like a defense lawyer would come in and you got to hear his case. It may be illogical what he says, but you got to hear the case. So one argument that is put forth is that his body was stolen. In fact, that is the earliest theory that was put forth. Remember when the soldiers came to the Jewish leaders and they said that Jesus is not in the grave anymore. What did the Jewish leaders say for these soldiers to do? Yeah, we're going to give you some money and you tell them that you were asleep and that in the middle of the night the disciples came and stole the body. Exactly. If they want to kill you and put you to death, we're going to step in. We're going to get your back. I wouldn't trust them, but that's what they said they're going to do. He put forth the money, and I don't know if they ever had to lie about it or not, but that was their argument. And you know what? That story was so obviously false. It's interesting that Matthew doesn't even comment on it. He just says that's the story that's been circulated even to this day. But I ask you this, what judge would listen to you if you said that you were asleep and your neighbor came into your house next door and he stole your television set? And the judge says to you, well, how do you know it was your neighbor? So I don't know. I was asleep, but it had to be him. Well, who knows what goes on while he's asleep? I tell you, testimony like that would be laughed out of any court. And stealing the body of Christ was something totally foreign to the character of the disciples and what we know about them. It would mean that they were perpetrators of a deliberate lie and responsible for the deception and ultimate death of thousands of people. The disciples weren't in the state of mind to steal the body. You remember at Jesus' arrest, what did the disciples do? They all fled. They ran away. They were forlorn over what would happen. And again, as we see them on the first day of the week in John chapter 20 in verse 19, they are locking themselves up because of the fear of the Jews. Are we next? Are they going to come and take us just like they did our master? They're in no mood to take the body. And if they had attempted to steal the body while the soldiers slept, could they have moved that large stone, which several women could not move, without even waking up one soldier? And would sneak thieves come in and place the stone completely apart from the tomb and then put everything neatly inside? Can you imagine someone breaking into your house and stealing your television set? But when they picked up the television set, they said, wow, these people haven't dusted under here in a long time. And so they get out the pledge and they start dusting down. And oh, there's some laundry over there. Let me fold that laundry up for them. And then they take the TV and leave. No, they get in there. They get what they want. And they get out. And that's exactly what we would expect with the tomb, but instead, the grave clothes had been removed, and they're they're folded, okay, in the tomb and placed aside. So why would sneak thieves do that? This theory doesn't account for the behavior of the disciples after they claimed to see Jesus. What would turn a band of fearful, forlorn people into a group of bold preachers who are willing to die for what they're teaching? How many people will die for a lie? You say, well, many people have died for a lie before, and that is true. Mormons, for example, there are many of them who have died for their faith, but did they know it was a lie when they gave their lives? I think they were deceived. People will die for what they believe is true, even if it's actually false, but they will not die for what they know is false. And if the disciples stole the body, then they're dying for what they know is a lie. Men generally tell the truth under torture or on their deathbeds. So if the disciples stole the body, then they would know they're telling lies about the resurrection. Does it then make sense that they were willing to die for that? What could they have possibly gained by that action? So it's inconceivable that all 11 apostles would stick to that story that they knew was false. And another question just in passing is, what did they do with the body? How did they hide it successfully? And even if they did steal the body, we need to account for all those alleged resurrection appearances, because more than 500 people said they saw him alive. So the stolen body theory doesn't adequately explain the facts. There's another theory that's been put out there, and that is that maybe the Jewish or Roman authorities stole the body. They moved the body. But the question is, why would they do that? You know, having put guards at the tomb, what would be their reason for moving the body? And what about the silence of the authorities in the face of the boldness of the apostles as they are preaching in Jerusalem about the resurrection? You know, the ecclesiastical leaders of the Jewish people, they were seething over these apostles in the book of Acts. How can we squish this out? How can we get rid of these people teaching about the resurrection of Jesus? They arrested Peter and John. They beat them. They attempted to close their mouths. But there's a very simple solution to their problem. If they had Christ's body, then they could have paraded it around the streets of Jerusalem. And in one fell swoop, they could have successfully smothered Christianity in its cradle. They could have said, no, he wasn't resurrected from the dead. Here's his body right here. So seeing they didn't do that proves they didn't have the body. Another theory is that has been pretty popular in recent years is that they had the wrong tomb. That the women who came on the first day of the week who were distraught and in the dimness, it was very early in the morning, maybe it's still foggy, and in their distress, they imagined that Christ had been risen from the dead because they came to a tomb and didn't see anything in it, but it was the wrong tomb. However, remember that the women carefully observed where they buried Jesus. In Luke chapter 23 and verse 55, the women saw where that happened, and it was just 3 days later. This theory also falls before the very one that the previous one did, and that it was, if they did have the wrong tomb, why didn't the authorities just say, well, no, here he is, he's still in the tomb, everybody come look? And further, it's inconceivable that all of Jesus' followers would succumb to the same mistake. The women go and tell Peter and John, and what do? They run to the tomb. Do they run to the wrong tomb as well? And Joseph of Arimathea, he's the owner of the tomb. He could have simply said, no, guys, you got the wrong tomb. My tomb is over there. And we also have to remember that this was a private burial ground, not a public cemetery. We think of everyone in our community being buried in the same place in a cemetery. That wasn't the case with the tombs. They were scattered in various different places throughout the countryside. And so there probably was no other tomb nearby that would allow them to make that mistake. So again, it doesn't make sense to think that they went to a wrong tomb. Well, that's right. That's a good point as well. These burial clothes are there evidence of there had been a dead body there, right? And why would they be in a wrong tomb? Good point. Okay, good. Well, another theory that is set forth is what is called the swoon theory. And in this view, Christ is said to not have actually ever died. That he was mistakenly reported to be dead, but had swooned from exhaustion and from pain and from blood loss. And that when he was laid in the coolness of the tomb, then his body revived. And he came out of the tomb and he appeared to his disciples, who mistakenly thought that he had been dead. Well, first of all, let me say this is a theory of modern construction. It appeared at the end of the 18th century. And it's a significance that not a suggestion of this kind has come down through antiquity among all the violent attacks that have been made on Christianity over the last 2,000 years. All of the earliest records are emphatic about Jesus' death. As we already noted, Jesus did die. There is no historical evidence to show that Jesus survived the cross. The Roman execution teams were far too efficient to let that happen. I want you to think about that for a moment. Think about the circumstances of Jesus. Jesus had been up all night in agony, sweat drops as blood falling from him. The next morning he went through the trials. He was beaten. He had to carry his own cross. He was crucified, hung on the cross all day long with a crown of thorns in his head. He was taken down from that. That burial wrappings were put around him, over 100 pounds. If he hadn't died already, he would have suffocated from that. They put him in a tomb, and we are supposed to believe that all of a sudden he gets up after that. He has the strength to unwrap himself, to get his bearings where he is, to move a 2-ton stone up the hill without any of the soldiers knowing about it, and come out and start appearing to his disciples. I want to tell you, it's easier to believe that he was resurrected from the dead than to believe all of that. We have to recognize that that certainly could not have happened logically. And if that theory is correct, then Christ himself was involved in flagrant lies. His disciples believed and preached that he was dead, but he came alive again. And Jesus did nothing to dispel that belief, but rather encourage it. So the only theory that adequately explains the empty tomb is the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And there are other theories that we certainly could discuss this morning, but because of time, let me just say in closing about the implications of the resurrection. Since it is the case, I believe, that Jesus did rise from the dead, there are certain implications that we must apply to our lives. And that is that the resurrection, first of all, offers conclusive proof that Jesus is the Son of God. As Paul stated again in Romans chapter 1 and verse 4, that he was declared the Son of God with power by the resurrection from the dead. Since he claimed it, the resurrection proves that he is who he says he is. His works testified it while he walked here upon the earth, but the resurrection deals this final blow to all unbelievers. Second of all, the fact that Christ was resurrected means that there's going to be a resurrection for all of us as well, and that we're going to have to stand before the judge, the one who was resurrected, and give an account for our lives. That's the point that Paul makes in Acts chapter 17 on Mars Hill, that one day we are going to be resurrected, and the proof of that, that we're going to be judged by Christ, is the fact that he was resurrected as well. We can be guaranteed that we will have to face judgment because Jesus was resurrected from the dead. Thirdly, the resurrection is the foundational hope of eternal life. Peter makes the argument, 1 Peter chapter 1 and verses 3 and 4, that we have an assurance that our hope is reserved in heaven for us by the power of the resurrection. Since Jesus was resurrected, then we know that we will be resurrected too. That hope is not merely illusion. Why should our hope appear as more than just wishful thinking if Jesus wasn't resurrected from the dead? We have to understand that if he was resurrected, we will be resurrected as well. Fourthly, we also need to understand that the resurrection and biblical moral lifestyle are linked. Because if there is no resurrection, Paul makes the argument in 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 32, we might as well eat and drink for tomorrow we die. We might as well live it up if we're not resurrected, if we're not going to face a judge tomorrow after we die. And so we have to understand, if Jesus was raised from the dead, everything he says is true, and we're going to have to give an answer for how we have lived in this life. Fifthly, I've lost count, maybe it's five, I think fifthly. Resurrection of Jesus Christ will cause us to worship him. It is interesting to see the reaction of all the disciples after they see Jesus. I say all of them, but most of them at least. When they see Jesus, they fall at his feet, they say, "My Lord and my God." I want to tell you, brother, when we believe that there is still an empty tomb outside the city of Jerusalem, it will cause us to worship him with excitement and enthusiasm. We are no longer going to have to be begged to assemble with our brethren. We're going to do it joyfully. We're going to sing our praises with all of our heart. We're going to sing out loudly. We're going to live daily for him, and we're going to do it joyfully, knowing that there is an empty tomb. Maybe the reason sometimes we lack the zeal that we do is because maybe we don't really believe in the resurrection the way that we ought to. But finally, if there is a resurrection of Jesus Christ, then it's going to move us to tell it to other people. Imagine that. Imagine one of your good friends here in Coleman dies. And then you know it's dead. You see him dead. You go to his funeral. You see him put in the ground. And 3 days later, you see him walking around the streets of Coleman. You're not going to keep that to yourself, are you? You're going to tell everybody you know about that particular thing. And the same ought to be the case with us as well. Isn't that what Peter and John say when they are told that they should speak no more in the name of Christ? They said, we cannot stop speaking the things that we have seen and we have heard. What had they seen and heard? Jesus and His resurrection. You see, someone has said that Jesus is either a liar, a lunatic, or Lord. We can't be neutral, but we've got to make a decision. And the choice is ours. Was Jesus a liar? Don't look at His teaching. You see that that is not the case. He was never one. The caliber of His teaching is not consistent with the evidence of what we know about Him and His life. Was He a lunatic? Was He just some crazy man who thought He was the Son of God? Again, study the skill and the depth which He taught and see if that's consistent with the idea of being a lunatic. The only option left is that He is Lord. And that's what the Bible claims. Appreciate your attention here this morning. Yes, sir.